Good morning, everybody. On this Remembrance Sunday. Remembrance. The Oxford Dictionary defines it as this: the act of remembering someone, something, or some past event. Or the act of remembering and showing respect for someone who has died. Now, I remember many years ago, going back to about 8 years old when I was in the Cubs, going on a remembrance parade with the Cubs through the city of Lincoln, where I initially spent most of my formative years. And I didn't really know what it was all about. I had no idea why I was walking in this parade of scouts, guides, Cubs, a long parade with bands playing, bands marching, and I had a blank screen in my head. I didn't know what it was about at all. We went into the cathedral, a long service, and it meant very little to me. And it took me some time to start to appreciate what it was. By the time I was in my teens, I was into the scouts, and I also went into the air training corps, and eventually played in a band, and was actually in the band playing, leading the column into the cathedral. And by the time I was in my mid-teens, I was starting to understand a little, and I mean only a little, of what remember about. By that time, I was at a school. And in the school, an old school, in fact the school during the First World War had actually been closed and used as a hospital for the First World War. On the wall was a large plaque in remembrance to the old boys of the school that had died in the First World War and also in the Second World War. And the picture of old boys conveyed to me of an elderly gentleman with grey hair, receding, glasses, moustache, someone like me. Now, really. But nevertheless, that's what meant by old boys. But in reality, they were in their late teens and early 20s. And at that point in time, I didn't realise that, didn't think about that. So my question to you today is, what does the word remembrance actually mean to you? I said to some, the word remembrance means little or nothing, even now, especially the younger generations who've had little or no concept of war. They may see it on the television, but they haven't really thought about it and realised it. To be fair, I'm one of the generations that never had to go to war, never had to face a war as such. So do you actually visualise anything yourselves in your mind, or do you just have a simply blank sheet of paper in your head? In August 2014, it'll be 100 years since the outbreak of the First World War. Why should we remember it? Why should we stop and think about those events that happened so long ago? Why should we remember anything to do with war? Many of us here, as I said about myself, have never really had to live through a war and really face the realities of war. This morning, we're going to look into the significance of remembrance and look at some of the symbols that have been used over the years, and also why it is that it's marked in this country both on the day of the 11th of November and also on Remembrance Sunday each year. And so that we really understand what remembrance is all about, this is what God has given me to bring to you today. Before the First World War started in 1914, wars fought by the British Army and the British Navy usually took place in far-off places around the world. The British people generally heard about it, often weeks or months after the event. And unless they're related to a soldier or sailor, the general public really were not really affected. They may see marching bands for the town on the return, a victory parade, but they weren't really affected. Those affected by the loss of a loved one in war had to deal with the effects of serious injury to their loved ones. And they were usually only the families of soldiers and sailors that were actually involved. In most campaigns fought by the British soldiers and sailors during the Victorian times, the numbers involved usually amounted to a few hundred thousand, and campaigns were usually over in a year or two, or in some cases, just months. In the Crimean War, for example, 1853, famous for the charge of the Light Brigade. That's a famous painting of the Light Brigade in action. Could we possibly have the lights turned off at the front, if possible, just so you can get a better view? Could somebody do the honours in locking the lights off, please? I'm hoping you see some of the photographs and images you're going to see clearly in the next little while. Just to give you some idea, 250,000, that's a lot. A quarter of a million British troops were involved in this campaign in the Crimea. It stretched over 2 years, but on the return, there were 20,000 less. We actually lost 20,000 of those soldiers in the Crimean War. And there's little unless you actually start looking for it to remember that particular campaign. However, World War One, by the end of the First World War, there were very few people in the country, in Britain, and even in the British Empire, and the other countries that took part, who remained unaffected. Virtually every family in Britain had at least one member of that family lost. Usually a son, or a brother, or a father, or an uncle, or in many cases a combination of all of them, who had been usually a serving soldier, or a sailor, or towards the end of the war, an airman. The war reached out and touched almost everyone's life in some way or another. At the outbreak of war in August 1914, there were approximately 236,000 regular troops and about 260,000 territorial soldiers, a lot more than we actually have today. We could just about muster 500,000 troops to mobilise and fight on the Western Front. Sounds a lot, doesn't it? But just to get this into perspective, the French, our allies, had three times the number of soldiers that we had. With the small Belgian army as well, that was our other ally, between us we could muster 2 million soldiers. Difficult to picture that number, but 2 million soldiers. This is where the crux comes into it. They said the war would be over by Christmas. Little did we realise that the German army was almost 6 million strong, and we were grossly outnumbered. By Christmas of 1914, the majority of our original army was either dead, wounded, or captured. It was soon realised that the war would not be over by Christmas. And a massive recruitment campaign was launched. Men were called to arms by the Secretary of State for War, Lord Kitchener. Some of you may recognise this poster, "Your country needs you." That still rattles through the ages to this day. There were volunteers enlisted in their millions from all over what was then the British Empire. Many countries: Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, but also India, the Caribbean, other parts of British Africa. Throughout the whole of the actual empire, volunteers came to help in the fight. It was truly a global struggle. Life changed forever. Nothing was ever to be the same again. In the opening moves of the war, both in the West and the East, the nature of modern warfare soon became clear. Armies were numbered in the hundreds of thousands. New ways of fighting made better and more effective use of huge quantities of shells and bullets manufactured on a scale that had never been seen before. The use of such modern weapons rapidly caused heavy casualties and laid waste to whole areas of land. Facing such devastating weapons, soldiers soon went to ground, digging trenches and dugouts that soon began to feel almost permanent. On the eastern and western fronts, there then began 4 years of almost a stalemate of trench warfare. Losses on both sides were tremendous. One of the infamous battles in British history is that of the Battle of the Somme. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. Some of you may not, but many of you will. In reality, there were numerous battles on the Somme, as the British Army was based on the Somme throughout the whole of the war. The battle the historians refer to was the one that started almost halfway through the war on the 1st of July 1916 and turned out to be one of the most costly battles ever in British history. The British casualties on the first day were the worst ever. Almost 60,000 men were lost in a matter of hours. 60,000. Now, when I went to school, and this is something that I started to learn in my teenage years, the school was almost 1,000 strong. That included the staff. And when I started to hear some of those figures in my youth, I thought, oh, school, wow, that's 60 schools. Nowadays, picture Hagley or Fair Oak. They're probably 2,000. So, in effect, we're talking of 30 Hagleys or 30 Friaries or 30 Fair Oak schools. Or Rugeley, the population of Rugeley amounts to just over 60,000. Sorry, Cannock, I apologise, Cannock, 60,000. That's wiping Cannock out every single person in a matter of a few hours. 4 or 5 hours, that's all it took. Furthermore, the battle went on for 4.5 months. The 60,000 was on the first day. To the middle of November, by which time over 1 million men had died on both sides for the gain of land about 5 miles deep into once-held German territory, along a section of front about 20 miles long. 1 million men. An armistice agreement, which is an agreement between the countries involved to stop fighting and negotiate, was finally agreed about 5 a.m. on the 11th of November, 1918. And that was to come into effect that morning, some 6 hours later, at 11 a.m. Fighting continued on all sides right up until the 11 a.m. deadline. In fact, the last British soldier that was killed or died 2 minutes before the ceasefire at 10:58. By the end of hostilities, over 5 million Allied soldiers, 5 million, including about 600 British service women, had died. In order to recall the end of hostilities of World War I, a memorial service was always held on the 11th day of the 11th month each year from 1919 until 1945, during which 2 minutes silence was held at 11 a.m. to mark the time that the armistice came into effect in 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Many of us will be familiar with that term. This Memorial Day was known as Armistice Day, and it was always held at that time, whatever the day of the week it was. At 11 a.m., people would stop whatever they were doing, wherever they were, and observe 2 minutes silence. That was always on the 11th of November, which is tomorrow. After 1945, the annual memorial service was renamed Remembrance and was moved to the second Sunday in November, which was nearest to the 11th of November, and was called Remembrance Sunday. Since the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, that was in 1995, it has become usual to hold ceremonies on both Armistice Day, November the 11th, and also Remembrance Sunday, which this year is today. The idea of national remembrance really only began after the end of the First World War, the Great War as it was known then, the war to end all wars, as it was often called by the generations that lived through it. Unfortunately, that was not to be. When the Second World War began in 1939, some 20 years or so later, after the Great War had ended, the Great War then became known as the First World War. Now we're looking at some of the symbols of remembrance that have been used since the end of the First World War. Does anybody know what that is? I actually happen to have two of them. These are the first real symbols of remembrance for the First World War. I'm going to pass them around so you can have a look. Please pass them along. Take a quick look. Have a feel of how heavy they are. Notice there is a name on them. It's a memorial plaque. And these plaques were issued after the Great War, and they were issued for all British and Empire service personnel who were killed as a result of the war. They were sent to the next of kin in remembrance of the loss of a loved one. Made of bronze, a total of 1,355,000 were issued. This was an early, very personal form and symbol of remembrance. It also came with a commemorative stroll and a letter signed by the king. They were eventually gained the nickname the Dead Man's Penny. These two were sent to my great-grandmother in 1919 for the remembrance of her only sons, George and Thomas Ladley, my great-uncles. And here's photographs of them both. George is on your left, Thomas is on the right. My great-grandmother had 3 children, 2 sons and 1 daughter. Her daughter was my grandmother. George, on the left, was a regular soldier. He actually was originally in a cavalry regiment, but eventually fought from the beginning of the war right up until 1918 and was killed in Flanders on the 6th of June, 1918. Thomas, his brother, was killed just over a month later, on the 12th of July, 1918. 5 weeks between them, and he was killed in northern France on the Somme. Imagine how he must have felt for a mother to receive a letter through the post from the postman on His Majesty's service, giving notification of the loss of the first son. I have four offspring. To lose any one of them would be heartbreaking. But to then, 5 weeks later, to get another one, to show that her only other son has now gone, must have been devastating. Most of us are familiar with the Cenotaph in Whitehall in London today, where there'll be, again, celebrate a remembrance service celebrating the end of the war, in the First World War, but marking those lost as a result of it. This is a photograph of its first unveiling on the 11th of November, 1920. It originally began as a temporary wood and plaster structure that was intended originally for a one-off combined victory and peace parade in July of 1919. But following a major national outpouring, a permanent structure was commissioned and built and was nominated as Britain's main national war memorial, yet another symbol of remembrance. That is its unveiling. This again is on the same day from a different angle. Most cities, towns and many villages throughout Britain also commissioned the building of their own Great War memorials. Some were simple plaques on a stone plinth with the names of those lost in the war. But many also bore a statue, often of a Great War soldier. Here's just a few examples. There are some local examples too, in Stafford and also the village of Sandon, just a few miles away. Many people will drive past them, walk past them, and probably not even realise they're there. Then, of course, there are the cemeteries for the soldiers that died, buried wherever possible near to where they fell. In Belgium and northern France, there are hundreds of British, that's a British cemetery, French, that's one near Verdun, and German cemeteries, each with some form of memorial, as well as their individual headstones. Here are just three of many. Typical German cemetery. This next one is nearer to home. This is on Cannock Chase, the German cemetery on Cannock Chase, where there are 4,500 German servicemen that died in both the First and the Second World War. Does anyone recognise where this is? Or what it's called? Some of you may have seen it or know about it. This is a place called Thiepval in northern France, on the Somme. It's near Picardy. It is the biggest single British war memorial in the world. Built in France, it's actually a metre shorter than the height of the Arc de Triomphe. The French would not have any building structure built higher than their Arc de Triomphe, so it's a metre shorter. On it is inscribed over 72,000 names of British soldiers lost at the Battle of the Somme. When I say lost, I mean lost literally. They were never found. Another very significant symbol of remembrance. The battlefields and trench systems of the Western Front stretched some 600 miles from the Belgian coast, through the Flanders fields, through the River Somme Valley, and on eventually to the Swiss border. They were constantly under bombardment, and towns and villages and vegetation were razed to the ground. Here's a photograph of the battlefields around Passchendaele, showing the appalling conditions of where men had to live and fight. After the war ended and the surviving troops returned home, they left behind them a desolate wasteland. Again, that's a view of soldiers going over the top, as it was often called. Once the conflict was over, in the next spring of 1919, the poppy was the only thing to grow on the otherwise barren battlefields, to such an extent that the remnants of the trenches and shell craters were covered by a mass of poppy flowers. Along most of the 600-mile-wide front from Belgium to Switzerland, the red poppy has been a symbol of remembrance ever since. The newly formed British Legion, formed to provide help and welfare to serving and ex-serving I did have a glass of water. I must apologise. Thank you. Getting slightly dry here. Sorry about this. The newly formed British Legion, as I was talking about, formed to provide help and welfare to serving and ex-serving servicemen and women and their families, adopted the poppy as a symbol in 1921. They used it for their first appeal to raise funds in November of 1921, and their first appeal was held in Britain and was seen as a resounding success, raising £106,000, which in 1921 was a lot of money. The paper poppies were all handmade by disabled ex-soldiers of the First World War as part of their process of recuperation. It was also as a means of proactive occupation, and it helped to provide them with the ability to earn an income for themselves and their families. The significance of the poppy flower as a lasting memorial to the fallen was realised by a Canadian Army surgeon, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae. And he wrote it. He was a poet. He wrote his poem, this one, published in 1915, entitled In Flanders Fields. A short extract of which I will read to you now, and it is only an extract. It says this. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. John McCrae did not survive the First World War. Remember that I said that by the end of hostilities in World War I, there were over 5 million Allied soldiers that had been killed? What I didn't mention was that there were also 3.5 million soldiers that were killed on the other side. A total of over 8.5 million men were killed collectively on both sides. Children grew up in the shadow of war. Their fathers were absent or lost. Women became directly involved. Without them, the war effort would not have continued. They worked in various engineering industries and also agriculture as the men went off to fight, including the need to work in very dangerous conditions in the munitions industry in order to maintain the supplies of shells to the front and ammunition, including manufacturing of armaments and other equipment that was used. There were a number of fatal accidents and explosions. By 1919, women could actually join up and join the armed forces and serve the country, especially in nursing and supply and support roles. So the war was not only about military losses. For the first time ever, it was total war, where civilians were deliberately targeted, and a new term, the home front, began to be used. The first attacks on the civilian population, particularly affecting women and children and the elderly, were actually by naval bombardment, especially on the northeast coast of Britain, early on in the war in 1914. In fact, Newcastle in the northeast was particularly badly hit. The first aerial blitz of Britain was not in 1940. Bombing tactics that had been specifically intended to target the civilian population began on Britain in December of 1914, with aerial attacks by airships and also bomber aircraft. Here is a photograph taken in 1915 of a German Zeppelin flying low over Westminster. Does it give some sort of perspective of how horrendous that must have seemed? It's enormous. Imagine what it was like for the people on the ground. It was only a few years earlier that the first aircraft had flown, and now your home was being overflown by this monstrosity, from which bombs were dropped with ease. And at that time, Britain had no effective answer to them. As well as attacks on the capital, there were numerous regular air raids over eastern Britain, with other raids also on parts of the West Midlands. Walsall was hit near here. Birmingham was hit. And surprisingly, as far afield as Liverpool, and even, believe it or not, Glasgow and Edinburgh were bombed by Zeppelins in the First World War. This next photograph shows the aftermath of a raid that destroyed a school whilst children were in it. where unfortunately many were killed. The next photograph is of the school remembrance service that took place some days afterwards. Towns and cities in both Belgium and France and Russia were also targeted. Food shortages, sometimes deliberately inflicted by blockades and sometimes resulting from failed harvests, weakened the people who remained on the home fronts. Nearly 6 million civilians died from disease or starvation during the First World War. Another 1 million were killed as a direct result of military operations. In all, the estimate of dead resulting from the war, both military and civilian, stands at over 16 million people. And then there were the wounded. This photograph is actually a photograph taken in my old school in the room that is now the main library of that school. It was used as one of the wards of the hospital. More than 21 million blinded, gassed, those with missing limbs, scarred and maimed. The families at home had to learn to accept and live with their loved ones who were now physically and mentally damaged by what they'd been through. Some of the war's effects on returning soldiers were not always obvious. Mental and emotional trauma caused by the effects of shell shock and sustained periods at war at the front were not at first recognised or even understood. And when they were barely acknowledged. Some recovered. Others were never the same again, either in body or in mind. The effects of the war were felt around the world, well after the war ended. The old world order was broken politically and economically. Both the Austro-Hungarian and Turkish empires ceased, and from their ashes many new countries emerged, both in Europe and also in the Middle East. Russia was racked by revolution and became the world's first communist state. Monarchies fell. A new world order emerged, with the United States developing a League of Nations that eventually became the United Nations that actually they later chose not to join. The consequences of many of these political and economic changes caused much dissent and unrest that helped eventually to lead to the Second World War some 20 years later. Some of that dissent and unrest caused by the outcomes of the First World War can still be heard to this day, reverberating troubles around the world almost a century later. Millions of people across the world are still connected with the Great War, for they knew people who were part of it and whose lives were changed by it. That includes us. Not so well known, another symbol of remembrance, is the white poppy. In 1926, a few years after the introduction of the red poppy in Britain, the idea was put forward that the black centre of the poppy, should be imprinted with the words "No More War." This was seen to convey a specific political standpoint, and the British Legion declined this move because they wished to remain a strictly non-political organisation. The Women's Cooperative Guild began producing white poppies in 1933 as the storm clouds of war once again began to gather over Europe, with the word "peace" imprinted on the centre. The Peace Pledge Union took part in their distribution from 1934, and white poppy wreaths have been laid since 1937. Many anti-war organisations around the world continue to support the white poppy movement, and they can occasionally be seen being worn or laid alongside red poppies on remembrance days. In some instances, both poppies can be seen being worn together as well. Remember that I said by the end of hostilities in World War I, the estimate of dead resulting from the war, both military and civilian, stood at over 16 million people. Well, in the Second World War, the figures were worse, much worse. Over 22 million military personnel were killed on all sides in the Second World War. 22 million. But what was even more shocking was that there were over 38 million civilian deaths. The overall loss of life was in excess of 60 million people, not far short of the total population of this country today. The numbers of losses during these two conflicts were so astronomical, they're almost too vast to imagine. One of the biggest single events of loss of life was by the use of the first atomic bombs in August of 1945, when two atomic bombs were dropped, one on Hiroshima and a few days later the other on Nagasaki, killing over 80,000 people instantly. 80,000 people like that. Can you imagine? A further 160,000 people, so twice that number then, died within 3 to 4 months after the bomb had been dropped, in horrendous ways. Here's a photograph taken in Hiroshima about a month after the bomb was dropped in 1945. Most of the city was devastated, but some buildings remained. This was one of them. The reason I've mentioned it is that this photograph shows that that building later, it was left in place. It wasn't dismantled. If you look in the centre of that photograph, you can just make out the same dome. That's the building still there, the ruins of it. And it became part of the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. And the ceremony is held each year in remembrance of the victims of the atomic bombs, and they also pray for a lasting world peace. Hope you can make it out, but there are hundreds of white doves released as a symbol of peace, which is part of the ceremony. Hope you can make that one out too. This is another peace symbol. It's one of the United Nations peace statues in New York. The United Nations, as a result of the League of Nations failures, the United Nations was founded in 1945 after the end of the Second World War. And one of their key aims, among many, is to try to prevent wars between countries. And another is to continually work to achieve lasting world peace. And that is one of their statues outside their main building. Back to our main National War Memorial, the Cenotaph in London, for a moment. And a more recent photograph, which may look a little bit more familiar to us because it's got colour. It's in colour this time, not black and white. As we as a nation take time for remembrance, so too do most of the other nations who've been affected by both world wars. For example, our allies in both world wars, the Americans, this one with President Obama, their Remembrance Day last year, and also the Russians, with President Putin. The French too. This photograph shows French President Nicolas Sarkozy laying a wreath with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the tomb of the unknown soldier at the Arc de Triomphe during the Armistice Day Remembrance Ceremony in Paris. Here's a photograph of the German remembrance ceremony attended by a German government minister in the absence of Chancellor Merkel. The Germans too have many peace and remembrance statues and symbols. This is just one, and is in remembrance of those that died during bombing raids on Hamburg during the Second World War. This next one is unusual, a little bit nearer to us, a bit nearer to home. This time, this is actually in Northern Ireland. And it's entitled The Hands Across the Divide. The peace statue in Londonderry showing two men reaching out to each other, symbolising reconciliation and a hope for peace in the future after the many troubles in Northern Ireland. This next one is a much further away. It's almost halfway around the world. This is at San Carlos Bay. And it's a cemetery there and memorial in the Falkland Islands in remembrance of those that lost their lives in the Falklands War in 1982. The next one is also in the Falklands Islands at the top of Mount Pleasant, again commemorating those lost in that campaign in 1982. This next one is more personal. It's a photograph of a simple and plain military cemetery in Argentina, and someone clearly in personal remembrance of a loss of a loved one lost during the Falklands War. This next one is amazing. This elaborate memorial is actually in Baghdad in Iraq, and it's actually in remembrance of Iraqi war dead. This is a ceremony where there are actually American and British troops joining the Iraqi troops too in commemoration of those lost in the wars. Many of you will be familiar with this image, this scene, in recent years, of Wootton Bassett and the return of military personnel killed whilst serving in Afghanistan. Which brings me to the next photograph of another national site of remembrance. This is very close to home, by the way. It's probably about 12 to 15 miles from here at the most. The National Memorial at Al-Rawas. This site has over 250 memorials, including many for various civilian and voluntary organisations. There is even, for the first time ever, a memorial to over 300 British First World War soldiers who were shot at dawn for desertion, many of whom, it is now believed, were actually suffering from the unacknowledged shell shock. Back to the main memorial. This main memorial is in remembrance of all those servicemen and women who've died since the end of the Second World War. And the names of those lost are inscribed on the inner walls of the memorial. Again, there are statues and symbols of remembrance around the memorial too. Not that you can see that, but it says men and women of the armed forces killed in the service of the country. I'm not sure, but I hope you can read some of this. But just to put it in perspective, this is a list of the numerous theatres of war that the British service men and women have served in since 1945. The list is long. I don't intend to read them out. I'm sure most of you will recognise some, or maybe even all of them. The shocking fact is, there's only been 1 year since 1945 when no British service personnel were killed. And that was in 1968. 1 year. Each year, more names are added to those already inscribed. I hope and pray that you all now have a greater knowledge and understanding of remembrance and Remembrance Sunday, and that your mind no longer goes blank at the word remembrance. The Great War sometimes feels like distant history. We can see a few often jumpy black and white movies on the television, fading old photographs of unfamiliar faces in unfamiliar clothes, old-fashioned cars, more commonly horses pulling carts, carriages, wagons. All looks like something from a world that's been long forgotten. Yet the last soldiers who fought in the war have only recently only died. Only a few of the 1914-18 generation who witnessed some of the war but were too young to take part are still alive. The war is slipping inevitably beyond the fringes of memory. And as the centenary of 1914 to 1918 approaches, we really need to work harder to make sure that we do not forget. For in order to understand today and try to avoid repeating history, we need to know and to understand and remember what happened yesterday. What does the Bible say about all this? A lot. And I'm sure you're going to be familiar with all the verses we're going to have a look at now. But we need to put these verses now into the context of potential war and conflict. In John 13:34, Jesus says to us, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You are also to love one another." It doesn't state any exceptions. In a war situation, this must be difficult. But if the next one is even more difficult, because Jesus tells us to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your fathers in heaven. And in Luke 6:27-28, he says, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you." That is not easy in a potential conflict or war situation. And also in verse 6:36, he reminds us to be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. He also reminds us to forgive. If you forgive others their trespasses, your Heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Again, certainly not easy in war, or after the war has ended. At the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus also tells us, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." We are all, as Christians, called to be peacemakers. And in Isaiah 9:6, we are told who Jesus actually is. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It is only right that we remember our armed forces and the price they have paid and that they continue to pay in carrying out their duties that are ultimately on our behalf. As Christians, though, we should also remember all of those lost on all sides, both military and civilian, as a result of any war. For as Christians, as you saw a moment ago, we are required by God to be peacemakers, and we all have a role to play to strive for peace throughout the world, especially in directing our thoughts, our prayers, and our actions towards the making of peace. Can I call my assistants out, please? I'd like Matthew and Sam and Ross to come to the front for a moment. Just to get, this is a graphic that I had given me fairly recently, and I've embarrassed these young people by bringing them up to show it to you all. But this is to try and show you conflict. If you could turn and face them, Sam, that's great. If you two could face each other. Conflict. These two have got a conflict. These two are going to fight. Put up your mitts, guys. Okay? And get look serious, because you're going to fight. No, this isn't serious enough. Come on. mean it. These two are about to start to knock themselves senseless. What would Jesus do, Sam? Push them away. That's it. Jesus is there as a peacemaker to try and stop conflict. Then what would Jesus do? Simple graphic. I just got the idea. Thank you, gentlemen. Please hang around. I shall need your services in a moment. We need to take that simple example and try and apply it in our lives too. As the saying says, we will remember them. I think it is vitally important that we don't just remember them, that we understand them too, and the circumstances that all of them have been through and continue to go through. But we must also remember that we need to follow the Prince of Peace. In Isaiah 2:4, Isaiah foretells us the triumph of biblical faith will bring peace the world has never known, when all nations will beat and shape their swords, their weapons of... excuse me. Their weapons of war into plowshares, essentially tools for growth. And Isaiah 2:4 says this, he shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Here's the last statue of peace to show you. This may surprise you, what I'm about to tell you, actually, if you think about the relevance of this. It is called, Let Us Beat Our Swords into Plowshares, and it's in reference to Isaiah. It was a gift from the Soviet Union to the United Nations, and is actually situated in the United Nations garden in New York. For us as Christians, each Sunday is a Remembrance Sunday. It is a Remembrance Day. Every Sunday for us as Christians. It's the day when we remember the sacrifice of Jesus, who won for the entire world a different and a deeper kind of peace. This morning, we are also going to remember Jesus on this Remembrance Sunday by sharing communion. Can I ask you, please, once you have your bread and juice, to please wait this time, because we're going to share communion all together at the same time. So once you've got your bread and you've got your juice, please just hold that for a moment or two. And now I'm going to call my young friends here to help. And in Matthew, Mark and Luke, we're told about Jesus' Last Supper at the Passover meal. And Jesus, whilst eating, just hang back a second. Sam, you've got to go around there. And Jesus, whilst eating, he took bread, he gave thanks, and he broke it. And he gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Thank you. Now you can take that. Thank you, Sam. Later, Jesus took the cup and he gave thanks and he offered it to them and he said, "Drink. This is my blood of the new covenant, poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Thank you, everybody. If you'd like to share communion at the same time, please feel free. Thank you, Carl. I will ask you now to please stand. I must apologise for not having this at 11 o'clock. However, part of this was to get us to all understand and have the same understanding right now of remembrance and what we are remembering, so that we don't have a blank sheet of paper or focus on one particular thing. We can think about everything that we've seen and heard, in particular, of course, Jesus too. So we will now have 2 minutes silence in remembrance of those lost. Father, almost 100 years ago, a world war began which wiped out vast numbers of young men and women from many countries around the world. Father, we ask you to raise up a generation of children and young people in the UK, in Europe, and around the world will follow you with a passion. May young people everywhere be encouraged to challenge the old and what has happened in the past, and be ready to unlock the new by following you.